On this episode of Skeptico, guest host Dr. Rich Grego brings us interviews from the 2012 Parapsychology Association Conference.
Well, then let's jump right into the first interview, and that's, of course, Daryl Bem.
Quantum theory, quantum mechanics, has never had an empirical failure. That is, to the degree you can measure, within the error of measurement, every prediction made by quantum mechanics has come true.
Right.
The thing that so boggles the mind of physicists in the 20th century was no one knows how it works.
Yeah.
So even Feynman, who won a Nobel Prize for all of this, said, stop beating yourself up by asking, but how can this be? Nobody knows how this can be. And psychologists and non-physicists generally don't know that that conundrum exists in physics. They say, well, I don't have the mathematical knowledge to know what quantum mechanics is. They should give themselves more credit. No one knows.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, as you just heard, we have some very interesting interviews from the Parapsychology Association Conference. I think you're going to enjoy all of them. Let's get right to the interviews. Today, we welcome back Dr. Richard Grego to Skeptico. Rich, as you may remember, has brought us some kind of feet-on-the-street interviews, most recently a few episodes back from the American Psychology Association Conference. And this time, he has a series of interviews that he recently conducted at the Parapsychology Association meeting for 2012. And I believe that was in Durham, North Carolina. Is that right, Rich?
Yes, it is.
So Rich is also, as you remember, a philosophy professor at Florida State College. He's an old hand by now on Skeptico, so we don't need to introduce him very much. We're going to jump right into these very, very interesting interviews that he's brought us from the Parapsychology Association Conference. So where I thought we'd start, Rich, why don't you give us a little bit of a feel for the conference in general? You know, number of attendees, kind of who were the people that were there, what it was all about.
Okay, yeah. The Parapsychological Association, of course, is the primary or one of the primary professional associations for scholars in the field of parapsychology. And the Parapsychological Association Conference is the annual, I guess, convocation at which these scholars share their latest research. And this year it was held August 2012, was in Raleigh-Durham, North Carolina, right adjacent, as a matter of fact, and it was no coincidence, to the famous Rhine Research Center that was formerly connected with Duke University. And, you know, since parapsychological research obviously concerns the cutting-edge controversial explorations and stuff regarding the nature and the substance of consciousness and cosmos, I wanted to get a chance perhaps to talk with the scholars there and obtain as many abstracts and summaries of the presentations and so forth for Skeptico. And there were about, I would say, a couple of hundred scholars there, researchers from various fields, like, you know, everything from neuroscience to physics to philosophy. And I wanted to, my project sort of was to gather abstracts and summaries of these presentations, as well as follow-up questions regarding how they felt their findings impacted evidence for a non-material consciousness or dimension of consciousness. So that's essentially was the nature of the conference and what I was attempting to do there.
Okay. Well, then let's jump right into the first interview that we're going to bring to folks and then talk a little bit about. And that's, of course, Daryl Bem. Why don't you set this up for us briefly with what his presentation was about?
Okay, yeah, sure. Well, Daryl Bem, of course, as most people know, is a preeminent scholar in the field of social psychology, I guess formally at Cornell. And, you know, his groundbreaking work in the parapsychological field was in the area of precognition, and this really famous paper in the Journal, I think, of Personality and Social Psychology caused a huge stir because of its really fantastic results. And his paper at the conference was entitled What I've Learned During My 15 Minutes of Fame, and it was sort of this informal but very interesting and insightful and entertaining, really, overview of the scientific community's reception of his work and the, sort of the culture of the scientific community now and current theories of physics and consciousness that relate to psi phenomena. It was really a very interesting presentation, and our interview in its entirety covered that stuff, and this excerpt is sort of in keeping with my main focus, regards his reflections on how popular, fashionable metaphors and analogies really have influenced scientific research on consciousness, as well as implications of that for physics and research in psi.
Great. Let's play that clip.
One of the fascinating things I thought you said, being a philosopher by profession, I thought was really particularly profound and insightful was you mentioned that, and this is switching gears a little bit from sort of methodology, but related, the extent to which, and correct me if I'm paraphrasing you wrong, the extent to which our metaphors for mind configure what questions we're permitted to explore with respect to consciousness is really interesting. And so I was wondering, what's the current metaphor, do you think? How is it shaping questions we're permitted to ask and how our methodology...
What led me to comment on this was back in the 50s when Vance Packard wrote the book, The Hidden Persuaders, was all about subliminal stimulations, a stimuli that are flashed so quickly that your conscious mind is not aware that they're there.
Yeah.
And there were a whole set of experiments done at that time that showed that people had different personalities reacted to threatening stimuli differently. And what you would do is flash a horrible picture or a sexual picture or something so fast the conscious mind couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. And there were claims being made then about how people react to this kind of threat. Can they see them faster or slower than other people, for example? And all of that sort of fell apart. People said that we don't believe there's subliminal stimulation, can't believe these experiments and all that, and so it just laid fallow for a long time. Now social psychologists use subliminal stimulation as part of their methodology. And the question is, what changed?
Right,
Well, first of all, people did get more methodologically sophisticated on how to run these experiments. But I think from the language used, you can tell that people's metaphors of what the mind is like changed, and that changed. Mm. Then it was more like a switchboard. The mind has, stimuli in, responses out.
Right.
And if that's the view you have, then to be told that somehow you react to threat that you haven't seen.
Yeah.
And so the people were saying, well, so who is this little homunculus in your mind that looks out at the world and says, no, don't see that?
Right.
Well, that sounds absurd. Yeah. I mean, it's almost ridicule to say that. Now, our metaphor has changed from a switchboard, and it's sort of implicit, to a computer.
Yeah, yeah. And is that the popular? Metaphor.
Sort of everybody uses it, whether they realize it or not, because you talk to your computer.
Yeah.
You say, dummy.
Yeah.
The information's not on the hard disk. Go over and look at it here.
And in daily parlance between people, you hear that.
And you certainly know that what you see on the screen is only a tiny fraction of all the processing that's going on in the computer.
Yeah.
So the notion that the human mind is at least as good as a computer, that things are going on underneath. So when you're working on a computer, it's making decisions about, you misspelled a word. Well, is this the word you really meant?
Sure, yeah.
Well, that means that there's all this processing going on. You can think of the computer screen as what's conscious.
Right.
And everything else, which is almost much, much larger, is going on. So even if people don't acknowledge that that's their metaphor, it makes the question, so who's this homunculus who looks out and says, don't see that?
Right.
It's just not a problem anymore.
Right. That's interesting.
Okay, so Rich, I'm going to break it off there because I've really broken up this clip into two parts because it's so great, it's so rich, it's so brilliant. I love what you've done and I love his answer. Let's talk about that first part. I love this little bit of history about how subliminal messaging went from this tremendous fad to being totally debunked to quietly being accepted as fact. And you can't help but feel that maybe he's drawing some parallels there to what might happen in the future with parapsychology.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I was wondering how you and or the, you know, the Skeptico constituency in general would sort of respond to that, because it is interesting about how the sort of the metaphors for mind or consciousness that sort of creep into the scientific community from extra scientific sources very often seem to configure what questions scientists are allowed to pursue, even for when they're investigating things like consciousness. So I was curious to know.
All right, the switchboard versus the computer analogy I thought was wonderful, wonderful, and really strikes home.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's play the second part of this clip and chat a little bit about that.
Are there theories of precognition, like sort of ontologically, what is going on?
Yes, well, there are a couple things here. First of all, physics had its moment of embarrassment, but extraordinary knowledge in the 20th century.
Right.
And so quantum theory, quantum mechanics, has never had an empirical failure. That is, to the degree you can measure, within the error of measurement, every prediction made by quantum mechanics has come true.
Right.
The thing that so boggles the mind of physicists in the 20th century was no one knows how it works.
Yeah.
So even Feynman, who won a Nobel Prize for all of this, said, stop beating yourself up by asking, but how can this be? Nobody knows how this can be. And psychologists and non-physicists generally don't know that that conundrum exists in physics. They say, well, I don't have the mathematical knowledge to know what quantum mechanics is. They should give themselves more credit. No one knows. No one has an understanding of the mechanics of how it works.
Right.
And there were bitter fights with Einstein ending up on sort of the wrong side of the thing. And so that has caused physicists to be much more humble or to just ignore it. I mean, there's a branch of physics that we call
shut up and calculate,
which means don't worry about the foundational questions.
Yeah.
And I don't think psychologists, just as one non-physics group, has yet had their world shaken up to that extent. Now, some psi researchers actually think quantum mechanics does contain the seeds of an explanation. It has to do with what we call quantum entanglement.
Right.
Now, there are technical arguments why that won't work, but every week in physics, there's usually some new paper that shows, guess what, we found entanglement at higher temperatures than we would have expected, or at longer distances, or at a more macro level.
In macro level,
And so some of the psi researchers believe that that's going to be it.
What do you think?
Well, there's a paradox here. I think at some point quantum mechanics may well provide a mechanism, but quantum mechanics does not provide us with an explanation of reality. That is, that we understand. That usually what we mean by what do we mean by understand? We mean that we can relate what is new to what we already accept as a given.
So here he provides this really fresh look at quantum mechanics and how we're supposed to understand it as a non-physicist. And I love how he says, you know, psychologists step up and call their bluff a little bit because nobody knows what's going on here.
I found that really interesting. And then the interview I did, a few of the other interviews, people touched on that issue, particularly the one with George Williams that sort of directly addresses the psi and the problem of consciousness. I think that was his title. But I think that notion that a theory for non-material consciousness and psi phenomenon coming from quantum mechanics is just almost as old as the hills as far as research goes. And I'm familiar with how ideas like entanglement and complementarity and observer-dependent measurement and all these things they talk about sort of relate to consciousness studies. But I always get the sense, and I think maybe this is what Daryl Bem thinks as well, that quantum physics, in a sense, just sort of pushes the problem of reconciling a mechanistic material brain with a subjective, intentional, qualia-laden consciousness just one step further back, almost without solving it.
Oh, completely. I think that's acknowledged when you really push him. And what I think Bem does a great job is making it clearer that that's what they're doing and kind of calling folks on this pushback that we hear all the time, which is, oh, don't start talking about quantum physics. You don't know what you're talking about. And his pushback is, yeah, well, you don't know what you're talking about either. And I think the way he relates that to real science, rather than just two people standing talking about how much they don't know about the gap here, I love his pushback about entanglement and how there's news coming out every day, and he does a great job of saying it, you know, entanglement at higher temperatures, entanglement at higher ordered biological structures. And I know I've
macro
just
structures.
Yeah, I've stumbled across some of that research and bounced it off of some folks in the neuroscience consciousness camp, and they're generally ignorant of that too. So I think he makes a very valid point there.
I do as well, yeah, and I think that is the common refrain you hear from the skeptical community, particularly physicists and neuroscientists who talk about the impossibility of these kind of dynamics operating at the level of what they call the hot, wet brain and all those kinds of objections. But I think Darryl Bem's sort of cautionary admonition to not come to such dogmatic conclusions at this point in time is a really good one. That perhaps the skeptical community should take under advisement.
And we really have to stop saying skeptical community, because it's really mainstream science in general. They're just running cover for everyone else who hides behind that dismissive attitude of, we don't have to pay attention to psi. We don't have to pay attention to parapsychology because you just said quantum mechanics and you don't know what it means. But hey, let's move on. You mentioned Williams. Intro that clip for us.
Sure. George Williams, again, his paper was on, it is entitled Psi and the Problem of Consciousness, which really enticed me because that to me was sort of the foundational question that was driving my own project and interest in parapsychology and these interviews. And he was the only presenter there, actually, was a relative unknown in the parapsychological field and community. But he's a very bright guy and very well read. I think by training he's an economist rather than a psychiatrist or neuroscientist or physicist or anything. But his overview was a very good philosophical discussion about how empirical research, like the global consciousness problem in the larger interview. He talked more about that in his presentation. He's particularly interested in that, how that kind of research speaks to the traditional mind-body debate. And he suggested that a theory for psi phenomenon and for non-physical consciousness generally might well come from quantum physics. And his the area that he thought was most promising in that regard would be David Bohm's notion of sort of the implicate order via the hidden variables kind of theory of quantum dynamics. So that's kind of what this interview was all about.
Okay, let's listen.
The most scientific thing we can do is simply, at this point, accept the data. That is, and consider seriously what it means to our world, to our reality. Now, my interpretation might not be correct, but at least I am accepting the data. I'm saying, well, you know, given the meta studies that Dean Radin and Jessica Utz and others have looked at, we should, if we're going to follow through scientifically, we have to now the evidence is basically in, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So that's basically.
Okay, and then in regard to the problem of consciousness specifically,
yes,
you did a really good job, I thought, of clarifying for a non-philosophical audience the sort of three general prescriptions. You've got materialism on one end of the spectrum, dualism, mind-body dualism in the middle, of course, and then what you describe as panpsychism at the sort of the other end of the spectrum, if you want to look at it that way. Now, briefly, materialism, dualism, panpsychism, what are they, and what are you contending then that psi is evidence of, I guess?
Yes. Well, materialism is basically the idea that everything, that is consciousness, is somehow emerged from matter.
Right.
And this is something that I think most scientists believe or are trying very hard to believe, even though there's not, no one really has any good way of explaining how non-conscious matter, atoms and molecules and so forth, can actually somehow give us consciousness. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and this is a very difficult problem. David Chalmers has termed this the hard problem of consciousness.
Right.
How do we explain why we experience anything?
Right.
Okay. Now, then there are some alternatives, and the two that I discussed, and I think these are the main classes of it would be dualism, which is basically somehow that consciousness, or maybe some people might prefer the term spirit, is fundamentally different from, you know, the physical body or matter.
Right.
And so, as I mentioned, the challenges of those who favor dualism is to try to explain how these two fundamental substances can interact with one another.
Right.
And then you've got what I term panpsychism, and I also used another term, neutral monism, and I think they're very closely related.
Yeah.
Basically, panpsychism is the idea that everything, all material objects, bodies, biological structures, and so forth, have some kind of awareness, have some sort of mental or experiential component.
Mm-hmm.
And neutral monism is a similar term, and that is that basically consciousness and matter are, you know, sort of like maybe two aspects of some sort of maybe some greater underlying reality.
And in your estimation, of course, psi phenomenon make belief in a very simplistic kind of materialism very difficult.
Yes.
Whereas one of those other two alternatives, either dualism or panpsychism, obviously comports with the evidence we have from of psi better.
Yes. The psi experiments, such as, for example, the Ganzfeld experiments, and there have been meta studies which combine all those different studies together and find that the results are very robust, that the effect size does not diminish.
Mm.
And I think Daryl Bim's paper with Chuck Honerton, and also Daryl Bim gave a follow-up rebuttal to, I think it was Wiseman, basically showing that if you follow the protocols that they've laid out, that you get very robust results. But anyway, in Ganzfeld, they use electromagnetic shielding to kind of like prevent any kind of electromagnetic transmission between sender and object.
Okay.
So there are really no sort of physical, there's nothing about, you know, the physical energy that can explain those kinds of phenomena.
Right.
And so we really have to look at something else. And as you point out, the main alternatives can be classified as either dualism or panpsychism, you know,
right,
or neutral monism.
And again, your contention then is the one possibly plausible scientific approach to reconciling the seeming impossibility of a material brain having this conscious experience, this conscious psi experience of other things, can be found in quantum dynamics. Is that fair?
Well, quantum mechanics is a very sort of, quantum mechanics actually has its own mysteries itself,
right,
and there are a number of explanations, but when you look closely at what's going on at quantum mechanics, those don't really fit very well with our normally accepted views of reality.
World. Yeah, the physical world, in other words. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah. Yeah, what we could call, let's say, the Newtonian classical, ways of thinking about
right.
our world. So, in quantum mechanics, you have basically, based on how the experiment is observed, you can get very different results, either that suggest some sort of particle-like, in other words, that you've got a particle, or something that looks like waves. And Niels Bohr was the one who kind of came up with the idea. It looks like there's some sort of the waves are actually some sort of probabilistic component of what's going on with these subatomic particles.
Right.
And as you probably are aware, many people seem to argue that that the observation, that the observer-object relationship is so integral and so kind of like woven together that you actually presumably need to bring in something like consciousness to really sort of explain completely the phenomena. Now, that's a controversial idea.
Right.
Not all physicists want to go there.
Right.
But it's difficult to totally exclude that as a possible explanation.
Okay.
Great. So you really get a sense for what you're talking about. I love how he seems to come at this so fresh. You know, it's like, hey, isn't Dean Radin's meta-analysis really terrific? And we all want to go, yeah, it is. I mean, why don't more people get it? And they hear somebody coming in fresh and going, yeah, that's just the data. We have to deal with it. Why is that such a novel concept that we have to deal with good data?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I was wondering how you'd feel about what he was saying. And in a sense, I guess his insights aren't necessarily original, but I thought they were very well articulated. And something that I think, if you're looking at the implications of Psi research in particular for what the nature and character of consciousness might be, I thought he did a really good job of sort of placing it on the spectrum there.
Right. And, you know, the big takeaway for me, all that is materialism is dead. Materialism has been falsified for all intents purposes. It's falsified. And that's the really big step. And I think that's how he lays out the landscape as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Okay. So next, Athena Drews.
Dr. Athena Drews is actually another fascinating person with a really interesting career. She's a psychotherapist by training, and she's actually worked in the past with Stanley Krippner and Chuck Honerton and some of these big names at the Psychophysics Research Laboratory at Maimonides during those famous experiments that Krippner did in the, was it the late 60s, I guess, at Maimonides Hospital. And she's... Her clinical specialty involves work with children, and she has this ongoing project via a website, if I can remember the name, I think it's called perceptivechildren.org, in which she receives emails from children who, among other things, have these sort of paranormal or parapsychological experiences. And her presentation, she gave several presentations actually at this convocation, but the one that I focused on was this fascinating quantitative, qualitative sort of comparison between a survey of email correspondences that she has received on her website over the past year with a survey of letters to Louisa Rhine at the Rhine Research Center. She was a very well-known figure, of course, at the Rhine Research Center during the late 60s and 70s. And both of these sets of correspondences were from children and teenagers, and she uncovered some fascinating just demographic data regarding age and gender and the type of phenomenon they reported, and talked about the comparison contrast between them. So unfortunately, the excerpt I provide here is just a segment of the interview in which I asked her to respond to some of the potential criticisms of her findings and speculate about its implication regarding nature of consciousness, of course. But I guess you should understand it within the context of that general interview and the general subject that she talked about.
Okay, let's give a listen.
I thought maybe if we could run down a list of possible explanations for these experiences that people might offer, what your response to them is. The first of them, of course, from the hard-nosed skeptics who don't believe anything, fraud or confabulation of some sort. Do you think do you get the sense that in maybe not a majority, but is there a significant amount of anything like that that you get the impression you're encountering in your letters or no?
I feel that as Louisa Rhine has felt when she received 13,000 letters from everyday people, that these are well-meaning, sane people who are not out to manipulate or to scam and be fraudulent in any way. There's nothing to gain from it.
Right.
And the emails, the conversations I've had through the emails, are very sincere and very sane individuals. And the parents, you know, themselves are seem to be noteworthy for being pretty normal people.
Yeah.
So I tend to doubt it's would be fraud on any level.
These are, and again, I'm anticipating the skeptical response, even from within our field. There are plenty of them now within the field of parapsychology,
right?
That these are children. So there's the issue of imagination. Would you attribute a lot or any of these or a significant amount of these reports to that? Just plain, they're seeing things in the shadows and really honestly making an honest mistake.
And that is a possibility, and I raise that to the parents, especially if children, say, between 2 and 5 or 6, that were imaginary playmates or normal developmental components, and it could be just their imagination. But they sort it out and keep a journal, and they look at some of the details, and they're consistent stories.
Are they? Do you follow up in that? Do you follow up pretty rigorously with a lot of them in that way to verify the?
For some of them, if they do respond, we do have a little correspondence back and forth around it, and I'll say, well, it could be imaginary playmates. I know from what you're describing, it's hard for me to tell, and they may follow up with another email with much more detail at that point because they're not sure about me either and this website. And what am I going to do with this information?
Yeah,
and it can be also the parents' reaction to it. You know, if they're into this stuff, they I was like, oh, tell me more.
Yeah.
The child may want to create more experiences to get attention.
Yeah.
But generally, I'm not seeing it as just imagination.
Okay.
Yes, some of that could be.
Yeah.
But I
overall,
wouldn't rule them
no,
all,
huh?
Yeah,
okay.
I wouldn't say they all fall in that category.
Well, we're not done with the skeptical responses. A neural malfunction of some sort, temporal lobe seizures or something?
It's
think?
Very possible.
Do you get that impression from most of them? Okay,
and
all right.
There are a small percentage of the parents are writing in that their child might have some kind of physical thing. We do explore that. I would say the vast majority are not.
Okay.
There could be a small percentage, but to rule them all out based on that, I wouldn't do that.
And the other one, and you're a therapist, so I thought you might, this might have occurred, I'm sure this occurred to you. What do you see the implications of that?
Well, I think that it's, the research, certainly, and the emails about seeing discarnate figures and spirits has the implication that there's a separation of mind and body that can occur at death, and that our consciousness can survive and does survive physical death. And possibly has other lifetimes after that, and this is not the only one. So that has a huge implication for a lot of religion and a lot of political kinds of things. People's own view of what this lifetime's about and their body is about.
Yeah.
So definitely that the mind, that there's a spirit in us that does survive death.
And your research has convinced you of that, or is convinced too strong a word for a rigorous scientist?
I would say my personal experiences were the foundation of it as a child, of wondering how this can happen. How can you have a precognitive dream about something that's yet to happen, and then it does happen? You know, how can you see things, after somebody's after someone's dead and have contact from them? What does that all mean? So it started me questioning, and the research just helps validate that, and the children's experience just helps validate that. We're all seeing and feeling the same thing,
right? And it is ultimately, do you think, the essence of what we are, or the essence of the conscious dimension of what we are, is immaterial? At least is the way the material, at least the way the material is currently defined, I guess, by science, because that could change. Or do you not want to make that bold statement?
I don't want to speak for the whole field.
Yeah.
Or
well, I guess I just was wondering
like
what your personal feeling on the issue.
You know, I think
based on your research,
I think in terms of our physical being.
Yeah. When your body dies, do you think you have a conscious dimension that will continue?
I absolutely do.
Yeah.
From my personal experience and from what I've gotten from children and from teenagers and, from the research. Absolutely.
Wonderful.
I don't doubt that.
Really? Well, I appreciate you giving me hope. It's certainly something, as long as you're sharing your personal reflections, it's something that I want to
speak for the whole field and everyone in it and all the researchers, but I know from my life experience and what I've, you know, the people I've come in contact with, the adults and children, absolutely, I would not doubt that one bit, that
very
we not only survived death, but we have had other physical experiences in the past and possibly future.
I see what you mean here, Rich. So what was your takeaway from where she winds up at the end of the day?
Yeah, I think one of the things I think was interesting, and maybe this is sort of an upshot in general of one of my main takeaways, I suppose, or has to do with one of my main takeaways from all the interviews I've conducted, and that's that you can't really study psi phenomena specifically, let alone consciousness generally, without addressing the whole complex matrix of sort of psychosocial cultural factors that encompass it. That's ultimately what her presentation emphasized, and I think it's one that that anybody looking at consciousness or working at the cutting edge of science in any field, you know, has to keep in mind. I think science likes to consider itself this sort of divinely unperturbed, objective sort of a enterprise that has nothing to do with anything else, and that's what makes it objective and impartial and unbiased. But I think to look at any kind of scientific phenomenon, and really, especially things like consciousness, it really needs to be examined within this whole complex matrix of other influences that influence not only the phenomenon, but perhaps influence the way people investigating the phenomenon are approaching it.
Awesome. And that's kind of a neat segue into the final interview we're going to bring folks. And that's with Van de Castel. You want to tee that up?
Yeah. Robert Van de Castel, another fascinating guy. And incidentally, he was only willing to talk with me after consulting and getting sort of obtaining a positive reference on my behalf from Andy Paquette, because he apparently has worked with Andy or knows Andy Paquette from other venues. And I had actually written apparently Van de Castel has had some bad experiences in the past. He's had a long distinguished career, and he's had some bad experience with prominent, whatever you want to call, skeptics or pseudo skeptics, whose names I guess I'll leave out. But that I guess the name Skeptico, when he heard it, kind of spooked him, and he didn't know if he wanted to talk to me or not. So Andy Paquette gave me a positive reference. But Van de Castel, Dr. Robert Van de Castel, he's a professor emeritus at the University of Virginia Health Sciences Center, I believe, and he's a former director of the Sleep and Dream Laboratory at the University of Virginia Medical Center, too. And he, again, his specialty besides parapsychological issues is, of course, dream research. And he's just widely published. He's edited a SUNY book series on dream studies and dream research, and written a book called Our Dreaming Mind. And his presentation basically covered his reflections on how dream research can shed light on both parapsychological research and what the potentialities, I guess, of consciousness are. And it's along with quantum entanglement, how it needs to be looked at or examined as part of a matrix of other minds and the environment and the world and the universe and the cosmos of which it's a part, I guess. That was the focus of his presentation.
Great. And here it is.
Consciousness is so broad, we can now start to gain access to deeper regions within our unconscious and program it, and through lucidity now speak without your stammer.
Right.
So you could now, you know, like that movie that was made with the British king with the stammer. So now you can overcome that in a lucid state. Or you can now start experiencing the divine, because a lot of times the sensational lightworks, it's, you know, the 1812 overture, or the, you know, 4th of July fireworks up in D.C., it's this incredible, explosive, beautiful kind of experience, and you can have that and think, wow, that's in me.
Yeah.
I have this wonderful, wonderful ability to experience so, so deeply, and you can appreciate, you know, some kind of a higher power. So it isn't like you get specifically, you don't become Catholic or Lutheran or whatever, but you really feel like, you know, there is some awesome power.
It's a channel to spiritual experiences that you wouldn't ordinarily have. And that's becoming, that's currently a current sort of a hot topic in dream research. To get back to the original, to sort of sum up what you think maybe are the implications of your experience and your research as expressed in this paper, The Matrix of Entangled Dreams, what exactly then would you say in terms of psi phenomena is occurring in these dream experiences?
Let me back up for just one second.
Okay.
For the book, I chose the title of Our Dreaming Mind. Hobson, who had been the guy going with the hindbrain, and that this was just all nonsense stuff, that the brain was trying to make a job of this goofy chatter coming through, his is called The Dreaming Brain. Okay. So I wanted to make the differentiation between brain, which to me is just a three-pound hunk of gray matter, to mind, which is to me a much more active, all expansive one.
Which is exactly what I wanted to ask you about.
Rather than the, which to me is the Toshiba computer here, the cell phone, to make it our, you know, this is now our conversation.
Right.
When you get done with this tape, in a sense, that's our tape now.
Right.
And so I wanted to convey the collective quality of that. So I think since everybody dreams every night, in your normal lifetime, you're going to have 100,000 dreams. So you're not quite born a dream millionaire, but you're born a dream inheritor of 100,000 dreams in a lifetime. And what do most of us do with it? I mean, if you really felt like that was what you were given as your inheritance upon being a human being, you know, you could prorate, you know, at age 40, how much have you still got of that, you know, of the original money you got. What have you squandered? How much have you burned?
Right.
How much have you thrown away? How much have you, you know, stayed with? And so to me, the psychic dreaming is one aspect of that. You can get creative aspects and do writing and all the things we mentioned before, the poetry, the painting, the art, all of that kind of thing, inventions would be there. So, and with lucidity, you can now gain access to all of these other parts of yourself.
Sure.
So the psychic one, to me, is saying we all are truly connected.
Mm.
You're living inside your skin, I'm living inside my skin, but that at some level, we're sharing our bodies. At some level, we're sharing our minds.
So great. What I love is he goes right there with the divine. I mean, that's one of my topics, as you know, and he's not afraid to throw that in the mix just as freely as he's throwing in shared consciousness and how that all might work together. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah, me too. And he and Athena Drews in particular were two accomplished sort of researchers there who weren't as afraid to and reluctant to speculate in that regard as some of the others. Even Daryl Bem, who eventually reluctantly, during the course of our larger interview, I wouldn't say admitted, he acknowledged that his research has led him sort of reluctantly because he began as a skeptic. He's very adamant about, and he calls himself still a skeptic with materialist leanings, but he said his research has led him reluctantly to thinking that consciousness probably has a non-physical dimension at the very least. I think he refers to it as non-local cognitive stimuli, I think he calls the non-physical dimension of consciousness. But Van de Castle and Athena Drews were pretty open about their belief that a career and a lifelong career of research in this field has led them to believe, based on empirical evidence, that consciousness at the very least has a non-physical dimension.
Great. Well, those were some great interviews. I hope people enjoy them as much as I did listening to them. You know what? You've touched on maybe one question we can tee up for a forum discussion, and that's this psychosocial part of parapsychology and how we can't really pull that from any kind of little lab experiment we want to do of guessing ping pong balls out of a hat or whatever we're going to do. I think that's a great point. I'm glad you made it. Is there another topic we might tee up for discussion as a result of this conference?
One of mine, I guess, related to that is sort of pertains to the character and nature of what we call personal or self-identity versus just the nature, which I sort of look at as a sort of a subfield of consciousness studies. And I think similar to what we were saying, I think that, the more the non-material character of consciousness is established, it seems like the more the non-local sort of extended relational character of our personal identity itself becomes apparent. It seems to me that the concept of a person as an individuated, isolated, ego-centered sort of being that's bounded by a physical body is obviously an inadequate concept of the human being, of the person. And for us to really examine human experience and do justice to it, we have to look at the human agent of experience as, at least in the context of a larger environment or world or universe. So that's one of the main takeaways I had from this interchange.
Excellent. That's something we haven't really talked about and I haven't fully contemplated, I think. So that'll be a good one to discuss. So thanks for bringing us that. Okay. So Rich, that was all good. Tell us about your website. Do you have any plans for publishing more complete versions of these interviews? And if so, might they appear on your new website?
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, at the behest and inspiration of Alex Securus, I actually constructed the website recently and posted all of the interviews I conducted at the American Psychological Association Conference and the Parapsychology Conference in their entirety on that website.
Well, we'll definitely link you up there, Rich, and I hope people do check it out. So, terrific work. We'll have to find where to send you next. This is really working out great. So,
thanks. Hey, it's a great pleasure and an honor to do it.
It's great for us. Thanks and take care.
Thank you, Al.
Thanks again to Rich Grego and all of our guests for all these interesting ideas. I think Rich did a nice job of teeing up some questions that we might tack, so there's no need to go over that. I will direct your attention, as always, to the Skeptico website if you'd like to find out more about this show or join us in that discussion we're talking about. The Skeptico website is at skeptiko.com. And there you'll find a link to our forum, a comment section where you can comment directly on the show, and links to our almost 200 previous shows. Well, I have several interesting shows coming up, including a very interesting interview with Dr. Mario Beauregard in a few weeks, someone who I really enjoy talking to and I think you're going to enjoy hearing from. Stay with me for all of that. But until next time, take care and bye for now.